Well, good evening and welcome to this live stream event. And it's great to have you back on board again, end of April now, 27th, and so much going on. Just before I bring Damien in, I just want to go through my normal comments about this is not financial advice, it's a general conversation. And if you need specific advice, please go find a financial advisor. Also, do play nice in the chat room. The stream is being moderated. And if we do have rubbish on the stream, we will cut it out. 27th of April, 2021, I got the date right this time. Use that What the World to get my attention if you want to get your question asked. And of course, you can also use Super Chat to get your attention, get your question at the top of the list, or indeed make a contribution to the ongoing running of the shows. So that is what I need to say. And I think everything is all good. So let me now see whether I can bring Damien in. Damien, are you there?
Yes, thanks, Martin.
Eureka, it worked. There was that little, I wonder if it will work this time. And great to have you on. Thank you very much. Very interesting month, of course, with markets topping out, hitting the tops in a number of areas, both locally and internationally. Talk about inflation is perhaps stronger than it was. There was an interesting chart I saw, I think it was this one here, which was quite interesting. Mentions of inflation on calls have more than tripled so far, pointing to higher inflation. So CPI in the US has gone up a little, but mentions of inflation everywhere gone absolutely through the roof. Now, you and I will perhaps get a conversation going around inflation because it's quite important. But the thing I'm really going to focus on tonight is this wonderful question about, do we invest locally? Do we invest internationally? You know, which is best? So I'll give you a bit of a lead in. And why don't you just start, for those who may not know, with a bit about your background and what you do?
Yeah, sure. So so I run a fund at Nucleus Wealth. We run ethical funds. We run superannuation funds and normal investment funds. And the idea very much is that they're structured trying to trying to set them up so that ordinary people can invest and put their own wants and needs across the portfolios, whether they want to screen things out ethically themselves, whether they want to change the risk profile. So what we're trying to do is run these Nucleus is the idea of this core portfolio where we're running all the sort of safe and more secure assets that sort of the more sleep at night ones, and then people can sort of jump in and structure those and get out of that what they're looking for, whether it's ethical or whether it's fundamental. Or changing the risk, or higher income or lower income.
And it's worth saying that the tie-up here is quite important, right? So walktheworld.com.au, there is a Walk the World fund, which is essentially driven, powered by Nucleus Wealth. So we've, collaborating. And in fact, I think it was about 9 months ago, I started realizing that the markets were in for a big lift and we needed some market exposure. So this was a really good way of getting into it. And in fact, you've done pretty well in recent times, haven't you?
The last couple of months have been very good, yes. So I think, we started with your initial conversation was very much around you saying, look, the central banks are all trying to push interest rates down to zero. They're trying to get people out of cash and into other assets. At some stage, you've just got to jump and have something involved in the market. And it's that, I guess it's the part we're certainly looking at, where we're seeing such great earnings growth coming through that yes, markets have been expensive for some time, but having at least some exposure to it, and as if the earnings growth that's coming through keeps coming through, and reporting season so far has been pretty good again, is that it starts to bring the market back, so it's not quite as expensive.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's interesting, the question about inflation, it may be just worth pausing and just talking about that briefly, because it's a very good contextual discussion, isn't it? Now, I think we've both had the view that, there's going to be some, tactical inflation, not least because you were coming off a very low base last year. So you'd expect inflation to be much stronger this time in terms of its movement. But that isn't necessarily the same as structural inflation. And with wages growth going nowhere, some people, I think I'm probably one of those, is suggesting that it's more tactical rather than strategic.
Yeah, and what you're certainly seeing from companies all around, was that talking about media mentions, or was that a company announcements, that one?
That was actually company announcements.
Announcements, yeah. That's what I thought. Because you're certainly seeing, but I guess what I'd say is for the large part, what we're seeing, or the way I'm interpreting it is there's problems with the supply chains, and changes in supply chains and changes in patterns of demand. These aren't structural problems that will never go away. So one example is when passenger planes are flying around. I think it's about 40% of the of all freight gets carried, or all air freight ends up sort of in the holds of passenger planes. And because we haven't got as many passenger planes, now there's other planes. You had to put on more planes, more just cargo planes, and they're charging more, and that's sort of flowing through to customers. Now the question is, will we never have the passenger planes back again, or and if so, will people just gradually add on more and you bring back the prices? I think there's also the part where people have been spending a whole lot more money on goods rather than services because they haven't been able to spend it on services. And so that's meant, there's more goods around and so the freight costs have been pushed up, largely because the owners of these freight don't think it's a long-term and they do think it'll come back. And so I think what we're looking for, that's a good example of it, what we think will be a transitory inflationary push. And even if it doesn't come back, we do think it will add more capacity and eventually those will come down. It's not a structurally higher inflation in that area. And just as you go through all the different parts, car makers can't get the chips they're looking for. Not because the chips are particularly expensive. They're actually quite cheap. It's just that the chips are they said last year they didn't need them. And so we had all the processes that were creating the chips for the cars all got turned into making them for iPads and phones and all the things that people were using. And so now when the car makers want it, it's not there, not because and so they're trying to push prices up because they're trying to get this scarce resource. But as the production lines start to come back on, it's not as if companies are saying, no, we can't produce these very cheap chips at a dollar anymore. They still can. It's just a matter of capacity and actually being able to have that ability. Mm. So,
and it's interesting, of course, because one of the questions is, how do you measure inflation, right? So, is CPI a good and effective measure? There's a bunch of reasons why CPI might not actually represent reality for many people. So others will look more on the wages side, and wages have been very low. We haven't really seen any growth above inflation, in Australia for a long time. And of course, the Reserve Bank is saying, oh, don't expect wages growth for another 3-4 years because you've got to actually get employment rates much higher, or unemployment rates way down. And central banks basically are really not recognizing any inflationary pressures at the moment. I mean, they're really not even talking about them, right?
Yeah, that's right. And you spoke about company profits. Company profits are booming. And the issue is, if you have to put your wages up, will you be happy to give away a little bit of profit margin in order to put wages up? And I think for a lot of companies, eventually, not now, but because they don't need to. But I think the answer will be yes. I'd like to think there's some and that means that inflation, even when you start getting your sort of first sort of waves of wage inflation, it might not necessarily flow through to the end products, because the companies are building up these big profit margins that they can eat back into, depending upon circumstances.
And interestingly, there's a lot of evidence of companies changing their employment structures, more part-time workers, more casual workers. There was a very significant report from the UK today highlighting what high proportion of people there are now on much lower terms than before COVID. And in fact, there was a speech at the press club in Canberra today when the ACTU were actually talking about precisely the same issue, that in fact what's happened is that the pivot between profit to companies versus value to employees has really gone remarkably off keel, and all the value is flowing through to companies and there's very little left for the workers.
Yeah, so it's the gig economy is spreading, I guess. It's that that was always the part for a few years pre-COVID is your Ubers and your DoorDashers and those types of ones were the argument was all they're doing is taking away a lot of the a lot of the worker rights and therefore they're screwing the employees down and giving them less not as good conditions, and that meant they can you create this big underemployment in Australia. And so, so that's, you know, there's an argument that's spreading.
Absolutely. And it's interesting that Ray made a point a little while ago. Inflation may have been hidden if they avoid the necessary common items and excluded in the calculation and include items not commonly bought. For England, it's about what the construction of the CPI indices are. Of course, it is a formula, and those formulas have changed over time, and some would say that they actually probably distort rather than not now. But on the other hand, the CPI figure is, of course, the one that then everybody bases their strategies off, including the Reserve Bank.
Yeah, and I think we've spoken before in the past on previous shows about this whole wants versus needs. That's the, you know, the most important, one of the most important things for me is that the types of things that I've seen lots of inflation are fresh vegetables seen a fair bit of inflation. Ice creams have had deflation. Healthcare has had inflation. Flat screen TVs and washing machines have had deflation. And so it's that part about if I need a new flat screen, if I'd like a new flat screen TV, I can usually put that off for a little bit. I can delay that purchase. Whereas the healthcare, no, that's sort of needed immediately. And so that's the question about. And I think that's probably the lived experience for a lot of people, is that the things you absolutely have to buy week to week, month to month, are the ones where you are seeing inflation. And the things you buy infrequently, computers and laptops and all those types of things, they're the ones where we're seeing deflation, and they're the ones you have the most amount of ability to hold off.
Yeah, and it's interesting, in my surveys, which I'm just updating for the month of April now, there seems to have been a spike in those saying cost of living have gone up, incomes have not gone up, therefore more pressure, more stress. Of course, job seeker, job keeper also fell off at the end of March too. That's coming through. I think we're going to see a higher stress number and more people in difficulty. So it's not it's not all a one-way street here. I mean, there are, I think, some pressures still definitely bubbling away.
Yeah, and the other one that sort of goes unreported a bit is the, I don't remember the right name for it, basically there's a government support for a business, for smaller businesses, where they had a reduced payroll tax for up until September. And so they're just starting to roll around now, where people are, so basically what would happen is companies would basically get another, smaller companies would get like another, somewhere between $20,000 and $50,000 a quarter of basically, you know, here's money you thought you had to pay as tax, but you don't have to pay it anymore. And so, and that's kicked back in again now. So you know, the argument is, I've seen the argument out there that, you know, that money really does help sort of fund the housing markets and other markets, and in terms of that just money people didn't expect to have that they did. And then as all of a sudden the payroll bill jumps again, that will have a drag more on the economy.
Absolutely. It's interesting because Nicholas has said, what's the long-term effect on the economy of higher inflation? Right, there's a bunch of implications.
Good things, usually. Yeah. Well, I guess I think about it, you know, it's this part about being too hot and too cold. You know, you want moderation in everything. And so the problem is if inflation turns into deflation, that's got a whole bunch of problems in terms of it's usually debt. The issues you have with anyone who has debt now is having to having that increase at the wrong rate relative to their income. So their incomes are shrinking relative to their debt. And there's a whole bunch of other factors that go into deflation. But let's leave that out. Let's focus on inflation. The problems with inflation come when it gets too high and it causes problems for people. But my take is very much that it acts as a bit of an oil in the system. If you've got a bit of inflation going through, it means that we can see adjustments in the economy a bit easier. Is that if you've got sort of that 2 to 3% inflation, it means that sectors that are on the way down, they can just sort of hold their wages steady in those sectors and people don't notice as much. And then other sectors that can be raising their wages, say at 5% per annum, until people start going from the first one back to the second one, and it's a relatively painless transition, as opposed to if you've got running too low inflation, you know, the first sector has to turn around and start telling people, no, you're getting a pay cut, just to keep the company going, and then you have more friction, I guess, with no inflation. And in my mind, that, you know, given us a, if it's the right type of inflation, that 2 to 3% sort of helps reduce some of the frictions in the economy.
Well, it's interesting because I've got this theory that this idea of 2-3% was set at a time when inflation is running much, much higher, right? And they were trying to drag it down and down and down because at that stage they had massive wage inflation. And in fact, it was wages inflation that was driving everything else, and the cost of everything was just going through the roof. I can remember it. I mean, it was horrible because basically you had to have inflation adjusted accounting.
Yes.
Right? So you had.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
I was going to say you have to report your results in real terms because it was moving so fast, right? This time we don't have the inflation driver coming from wages at all, right? So there's a bunch of issues to do with, as you say, supply chain wobbles and, you know, shortages, and we've also got some goods and services that seem to be in short supply, and that may put some price pressures up. Containers, for example, are out of place at the moment, so cost of containers have gone up. But most of that is the sort of stuff that can get hammered out just by getting the supply chains to work more efficiently. So it's it's a fundamentally different type.
Yeah, and none of those, like if you look at containers as the example, saying has something changed in the container market where these guys can no longer produce the containers at the same price as what they used to? And the answer is no. There's some frictions in it. There's some, you know, we had suppliers in China who are off, or we had suppliers in India and they can't access whatever they can't access. So there's issues in terms of short-term issues, but none of it's like, we can no longer get the inputs at the same price we used to get the inputs for is generally not the case. And especially as so much of these tends to be capital inputs now as well. Like people talk about the commodity prices booming and that's sort of causing all the problems. But the actual prices of commodities tend to be a very, very, very small part of the overall one. It's the capital that goes into it, the transport and the marketing and everything else that sort of sits around it.
Absolutely. It's interesting because Ray said, there is no way continuous price increases is not sustainable. Wages have to match it enough. If not, then eventually the economy fails dramatically. So you've got this sort of weird tension between the two sides, right?
Yeah. And that's very much what I'd, got a bit of a story to tell, you know, in terms of this international, you know, how do we get there? Because it is worth sort of taking that step back in terms of what's looking at the recovery this time around, and we're sort of talking about it being an amphetamines recovery, like everything's just sped up versus what we've seen in past cycles, and so it is very different this time around to what we saw after the tech wreck and after the financial crisis. What we saw was very much that that we'd see China was leading us out of the economy, and the US was lagging behind it. The issue this time around is we actually think it's the other way around, where you'll see the US is actually the one that's going to be very much leading the growth surge in this one, and China's going to be pulling back. They came out a lot earlier than others, but they've sort of seen a lot of their growth already come through, and we think that that's going to be they're now in the stage of trying to slow down and try and really reorient the growth a bit better. Should I launch into some of that?
I think it would be good to do that, because basically the question which we're trying to pose is local versus international, right? Where are the sort of the hot spots, opportunities? And I guess, to start the conversation, if you look at the growth of the index here in Australia and compare it with the US, the US has done significantly better.
Yeah, absolutely. And much more so if you look in a constant currency as well. So, you know, the first thing I start with for any investment, for an Australian investor overseas, is that it's actually a reasonable hedge. The Aussie dollar works as a reasonable hedge, and it actually reduces some of the volatility. So ordinarily, people look upon Australia, like foreign investors look upon Australia, as this supercharged market, because what happens is when the economy is going well and commodity prices go well, then the Aussie dollar goes up and the stock markets go up. And so they get this double whammy effect on the way up. And then vice versa, when things start to slow down, economic growth globally to slow down, then commodity prices fall away, and the Aussie dollar falls away, and so you get like double the upside and double the downside. It's thought of as a very volatile market. The thing is, if you're, so that's how it looks from the outside looking in. If you're inside and looking out, it actually reverses, because what happens is when world markets, when markets are going well and stock markets are going up, the Aussie dollar goes up, and that sort of actually reduces your profits from international, and then flips around. So when things start to go badly, and say the international, say the global markets fell 10% and the Aussie dollar fell 5%, that actually offsets half your losses for you. And so it actually works as the Aussie dollar works, you know, often works as quite a nice shock absorber in terms of making an investment and sort of reducing some of the risk you can get from that. So so with that behind us, I guess I wanted to start back about the with some of the real big structural forces. And I spoke about that whole pendulum, you know, inflation is no good and too high is no good as well. It's somewhere in the middle. And I think there's, in our view, liberalism and economic orthodoxy has been going through a similar type of phase where for much of the sort of 60s, 70s and 80s, there was this huge specter of communism out there, which meant that capitalism needed to be quite constrained. And the idea was that, yes, you could rip off your workers, but you didn't want to a certain extent, but you didn't want to rip them off too much, because if you rip off people off too much and you get too much of a wealth gap, then the worry is your country will turn communist as sort of, you know, a third of the world had already done. Then you sort of hit the 80s and the 90s and you got the Reaganism and Thatcherism and this idea that you need to free economies and open them up. And to some extent, they were, well, just to a large extent, they were right, was that there's sort of been over-regulation and now you needed to, and by opening up, you generated all these benefits. The problem is the orthodoxy kept on going and you've sort of hit this stage where, arguably a lot of the economies sort of run for the billionaires and the corporations. And they've sort of captured a lot of think tanks and a lot of the economic thought behind that, and the whole idea that what you need is more tax cuts and more tax cuts, and that's what's going to solve the problem, and getting rid of regulations, and there's all these thoughts behind it in terms of we've seen workers' wages really stagnate across the developed world, and this whole version of extreme liberalism that is got to the stage where it's all about the corporates and corporate profits and less about how do we get wage growth. And so I think for us then we look at China went through this liberalism part as well, where the idea was they joined the World Trade Organization, they got access to all these world markets, and in return for that, they would then open up their economy to the rest of the world, and they would become more liberal over time. And they did that initially, but then they started walking it back. And especially in the last few years, they've been sort of becoming more authoritarian, rather than less. And I guess people and the workers generally, in my view, aren't stupid in the longer term, and they work it out. They don't understand why things are happening, but they do understand that things aren't getting better. And I think that's where Trump really benefited from that in the US, because he identified it. He wasn't there saying to people, guess what, guys, you've never had it better. He recognized that there was a whole cohort of the American economy who had suffered from the rise of China and had lost their jobs or had been on stagnated wages, and he tapped into that. He had the wrong solutions, in my view, but he was very apt at sort of tapping into that that thought process. And so, somebody stands up and says they have the solution. It wasn't the solution. The solution he had was more tax cuts, less regulation. All the things that got us in that trouble in the first place was pushed out to be. And so, America's now pivoted back to the center. And what I think is good about it is that Biden now has to come out with a package that really tries to address this, the wages of the deplorables, and actually tries to address that lower socioeconomic groups, because they're very clearly seen now. If they don't address the needs, then the Republican Party will stand up and take those people who, you know, years ago would have voted solidly Democrat and have taken them across to the Republican side. So that's sort of the big, you know, liberal structural forces sort of affecting the world. And on the other side as well, we've got China very much moving into this sort of middle income trap, where they've got a lot of their good gains, where, you know, building the first bridge across the river makes a huge difference to people. The second bridge, you know, gets rid of the traffic on the first bridge, there's productivity with it. But by the time you get up to the 10th and the 15th bridge, you're starting to really, you're not getting the same productivity gains. And the debt, you can see that very much in the debt in China, the amount of debt they're having to grow and how quickly they're having to grow, is really making a difference as they're sort of falling into this, what we call the middle income trap that so many economies before China have sort of fallen into. Whether it be places like Cuba or Brazil or Russia, all these countries that sort of made it to the middle income and then couldn't make it to the next stage of actually innovating and growing through that. China sort of followed very much of a similar path to all of those other countries, and we think it's reaching the end of that path now. It's sort of and the growth in debt is the clear indicator, because if you're spending money and it's being productively applied, then your debt tends to either stay stable or even fall, which is what we saw in China for the first sort of 5-10 years of the growth. And then now the issue is that, you know, that's really starting to slow down. So we've got this idea that these forces of liberalism are starting to swing around the other way. And so globalization was one of the big things that was the real push, and that whole hollowing out and shifting everything offshore. It was great for profits, and it still is great for profits. It's not good for social cohesion. And now we're starting to see tension really rise in terms of China as it falls into this middle-income trap. And it can see that the growth is slowing and it's not getting the same economic effect. Is it sort of starting to revert to nationalism? And, in our view, that's sort of the most likely sort of next step is really sort of this idea that it's Cold War 2.0, and you sort of start to break into either China-centric countries or US-centric countries, and the spheres of influence sort of start to separate. The good thing for Australia is that most of our exports are commodities, and it doesn't actually, as we saw, China banning a lot of them, it doesn't actually really make that much difference. If you China bans a barley, I think I even spoke about this on your show, as it was happening, was that it'll go somewhere else. There's a certain amount of barley in the world. China will buy barley from the Middle East, and Australia's barley goes to the Middle East, and it sort of all it all sort of moves around. So the big battlegrounds, I think, in terms of this China versus Australia, sort of US sort of centric areas, is going to be very much in terms of technology. And so the climate change technology and that whole push towards solar power, wind power, battery costs, really driving those down. So we see energy costs sort of peaking. And I think I've shown it before on your show, but if not, we've got a lot of slides, online about that, just really showing how those solar power costs, it's on a technology curve. Every year it just gets cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And the same thing's happening with batteries. And now they've reached the point where in Australia it's pretty much on par, which is why we're seeing so much renewable power come on. Australian electricity prices are a lot higher than what they are elsewhere, and we've got much better solar resources. And so what you're seeing, I think, in Australia is what is a bit of a prelude of what you'll start to see elsewhere as that prices peak. And that's sort of this one of these battlegrounds. Robotics is another one. Very much over the next few years, we're expecting to see anything that's manual sort of become processed and turned into robotics, and that's another huge driver of economic growth. And that both of those will sort of come together at some stage in what we think is this whole electric vehicle, but more in particularly in terms of the driverless cars, really freeing up a lot of expense, a lot of money for people, and creating a lot of productivity gains. So So that's the sort of big picture. And you know, what does that mean? Australia is you know, what's Australia got going for it, and what hasn't it? Our biggest export is iron ore, and so the issue for China is China's built. Every time China starts to slow down, they go out and build a lot more apartments. So that's where most of the iron ore goes into. And but what they're trying to do, that was like their default in terms of how do they sort of juice demand in order to keep the economy ticking over, is they go out and throw a lot more money into building apartments with the idea that they are urbanizing, but the urbanization rate has slowed quite dramatically. So they're going through, they're past the middle of their sort of S curve of urbanization, where they were moving sort of 25 people a year into cities, and now it's back under 20 million. So there's still lots of people going into cities, but it's less than what it was before, which means they don't need as much iron ore, and so they don't need as many apartments as what they used to use. So we're expecting that'll keep fading away. The China demographically had a one-child policy, and so... and that's starting to play in terms of the number of workers now is starting to decline. So in terms of China, all these factors that drove Australia and drove commodity prices in Australia, we think are starting to reverse. Australia lost most of its manufacturing base. That's what they're going to have to get back in order to actually make a you know, keep producing as iron ore prices fall and to be competitive in the world, we'll need some more of that manufacturing and more services. We're thinking a lot of the Chinese tourism isn't coming back. We think a lot of the Chinese students are never coming back. And so as the world sort of splits into these two paths. And so what that means for Australia is you need a lower Aussie dollar. Somebody's putting on a lawyer in their global operations, and they need somebody in the Asia Pacific time zone. They need to look at Singapore, Japan, and Australia and decide, yes, it's cheaper to put somebody on in Australia than what it is in these other areas. That's where I'll put them on at the moment. And until you see the Aussie dollar lower, we're not expecting that to be we're expecting the move over the next sort of 5-10 years will be that gradually lower Australian dollar to actually restore some competitiveness as commodity exports come off. And so what that means is that that's a positive in terms of the positive in terms of any investment offshore, is that Aussie dollar is your sort of your wind headed in the right direction over the next sort of 5-10 years. Secondly, then is where can we have problems in terms of the international markets, and I think emerging markets are the biggest danger. Their vaccine rollout is not as strong as elsewhere, and it's going to be a lot slower than what we've seen elsewhere. So they're going to be coming out. They're going to be one of the slowest economies to come out of this whole process. They've got a lot of US debt, sort of often sits in markets as well. So there's danger that if the US is sort of booming and you're seeing major stimulus packages in the US and that real push there, is that what you'll find is the US dollar rises, and that increases the debt burdens of these economies that still aren't out of the coronavirus and still got sort of shutdowns and problems there. And so that could easily cause, that's analogous to the Asian crisis. So it's not a base case, but it's certainly a risk case that we need to be aware of in terms of how we're in the markets. And so So we're looking very much at a US growing quite strongly. There's UK's we think will come out relatively strongly as well, although there's issues about within that country about which stocks and which sectors you're getting. But it's now a question about how do I pick up US growth relatively cheaply, because the US market is quite expensive. And for us, it's about trying to find companies, and there are lots of them around that tend to be listed elsewhere, but actually have pretty big exposures back to the US. So whether it be something like a Unilever, which is listed in Europe, and their biggest market though is the US market. There's numerous companies. Whether we were looking at cement makers a few months ago, We wanted to get exposure to that US, the US stimulus as it rolled on. And in terms of the cement makers, what we found was that you could pay, you know, almost twice as much for ones that were listed in the US, or you could buy, you know, we bought one listed in Denmark and one listed in Switzerland, and got them for, you know, almost half the price as what you'd get from the US. But they've got huge exposure to the US and will be one of the biggest beneficiaries of all this spend. So yeah, so that's sort of the I guess a broad sweep of where I'm headed. I might, I know I've been talking nonstop for a while, Martin. I might throw back to questions and
That's good. And look, it's a fascinating set of mega trends you touched on, right? Because effectively what you've got is a geopolitical axis, right? And as you say, there's definitely a building China versus the US, but of course Russia and China are collaborating more. They've announced, for example, they're going to do some joint work in space. They're going to put their own space system, you know, and you know, the International Space Station will now be not quite so international. We know that's happening. We also know that they're collaborating with regard to some of the defense issues too. So you've got one axis there. Then, of course, you've got the US, and you know, with Biden in, he's got a very different perspective in terms of US's role in the world, which is, I think, probably more internationalist than under Trump. But you've got that sort of tension pulling in two directions. But there is a fundamental philosophical question, right? To what extent, for example, is neoliberalism now under the microscope, for example, in the US? Because it's been rampant for years and years. And of course, we you know, we've got the same here. So is there a bit of a change in the wind, or is it really just more pretty superficial, and really it's just a slight change of emphasis, and really nothing has changed? It's still debt driven, it's still financialization driven, it's still fundamentally driving the mechanisms that actually create more corporate profit, less wealth for everybody else, right? Is that still there? It seems to me it probably still is.
Yeah, look, I think we're starting to take some steps away from it. I don't think we're there yet, absolutely not. And that's part of this whole idea as an investor. You know, how do I get exposure to those themes? And it's recognizing that these aren't, you know, you can recognize these aren't themes that are going to go on forever. And the extension of this, you know, this continual growth in profits at the expense of workers' wages isn't a sustainable solution. And you do end up with you know, political unrest if it heads to too far extremes. But I think there's enough signs for me that it isn't reversing just yet. It's still, you know, still playing that idea that profits are still going to keep pushing higher, and the coronavirus you know, was a great example. I think you had a chart you were going to throw up of some of the growth in US profits. Was that?
Yeah. So this is quite an interesting one. I'll just throw this one. This is actually part of a series that I did a post on the other day. This is actually looking at the long-term trends in the Dow, actually, and basically they did an adjusted view logarithmically right back to the 1910s, right? And basically what they've shown is that we've had a couple of times when we've got value way above long term, and we've now hit again, we've hit it, you know, a few weeks ago, we've hit that same trend line, and we're now going off in a completely new direction, right? So it looks as though prices in the US are priced in, well, probably on the assumption that things are looking extremely good. And indeed, earnings expectations, right? EPS expectations growth has gone through the roof. So, you know, everyone is now saying, well, you know, are we in a new world? Are we actually essentially, you know, able to drive significantly stronger growth than we did previously? And that's, of course, why the markets are actually where they are. The question is, of course, is whether this is really a sustainable view, or whether it's actually just a short-term reaction to all the quantitative easing that's been thrown into the system at a time when wages are under intense pressure. That's the big question for me, because I think a lot of it is artificial. A lot of it is driven by the quantitative easing programs that really are driving, for example, share buybacks. Share buybacks have gone through the roof in the last few weeks in the US, for example.
Yep.
So in a way, is this just massive distortion?
Well, look, there's certainly distortion there. I guess the question is, you know, there's some flows diagrams you can do where you sort of say, okay, we've got, you know, the government's one part of the economy, corporates are another part, and consumers are another part. And if the governments are out there spending lots of money and increasing their debt, and it's not ending up with consumers, then that means that the only one left who's really benefiting is the corporates in terms of corporate profits. Now, it's an oversimplification of how it works, but I guess the issue for me is that, as you said, wages are low. There's lots of money floating around, so people have more money within, certain pockets of people have more money, and your costs are relatively constrained. Rental costs are falling. You know, there's a lot of companies that are actually doing quite well out of this in terms of the in terms of profitability, and you know that graph you had there sort of showed over the last few weeks, you know, I think it was about 10%, was it, on that that sort of jump you'd seen.
And so you mean this one here?
Yeah.
So the EPS was 20 to 30 something, so you know, it's gone up by 10%, and the forward expectation is even more.
Yes. And so I guess this is this part about what I was talking about, you know, about how expensive the markets are. If you get 10% EPS growth, then that brings markets back to no longer being, you know, quite historically expensive. So in terms of my numbers, I think the markets, the global markets were sort of a little bit over 20. The US was a little bit higher, but you know, you add 20 times, so the price divided by the earnings is about 20 times, which is historically high. You've sort of seen higher in the tech boom, but that's about it. But if you see 10% earnings growth and that brings that back to 18 times, well, 18 times, that's, you know, we've reached there lots of times. It's sort of, it's been close to the high point, but markets have reached that level, you know, quite a number of times. And you get another 10% of profit growth, unexpected profit growth that sort of comes through, and now we're back to 16 times, which is, you know, getting closer to the longer term averages. So, so I guess what I'm saying is, you know, profits are really where it's at. And until we see wage growth, it's hard to see what's going to slow those profits down. You know, we've got record low interest rates. We've got there are commodity prices, short-term issues with supply chains and everything like that. But what might even come out of some of those is that someone will go, yes, I've got supply chain problems. Everyone needs to put up their prices by 10% because of whatever, you know, problems getting some sort of part from forever, and then the consumers take it, and then the companies are like, well, now we've fixed our supply problems, so we're going to put our prices back down 10%. So they might start edging them down, and depending upon how competitive the sectors are, but you know, for a lot of sectors that are sort of, you know, quasi oligopolies, especially in Australia, chances are they'll keep the price rises and let it flow through the bottom line.
Exactly. Now, it's interesting, there's a few questions coming in from Vanessa, for example, asking on things like, so, you know, where's the Aussie dollar going? Is it going to go down? How far down does it need to go? She also asked about Treasury bonds, you know, where do you think they're going? Because, of course, the long-term bonds were actually quite strong. They've sort of eased a little bit, but it looks as though they're signalling higher rates later. And what does that mean also for silver and gold, she asked? So there you go. You got a whole bundle of Vanessa questions.
Yeah, sure. Okay, let's start with the currency first, because I think there's from our perspective, that medium term, let's call it, Aussie dollar lower is what we're looking at. The shorter term cycles are harder to pick in terms of whether, you know, is it up or down, or, you know, next week or the week after, you know, your guess is as good as mine. But what we do see is that China is restructuring away from and from spending on apartments and trying to promote consumption. They're actually doing, I think, the consumption month, or 2 months of consumption. They're trying to convince everyone to go out and spend more money, because they want the growth to come from consumption. They don't want to have to go out and build more apartments and bridges and all these things just to keep people employed. The other part is China's looking very much to start expanding on the technology side. So as long as and switch away, so more spending on R&D. So as long as that happens, in the Aussie dollar, and in particular the iron ore price, is the part where that will start coming off, and that's where, what we think will bring the Aussie dollar down. Though there could be short-term spikes, so you know where it gets to first, but it's certainly at a level now where I'm comfortable in terms of saying now's the time to start accumulating these international assets. The higher the Aussie dollar is, the cheaper you can buy international assets at. And so if you can use any rises in the Aussie dollar from here to really start accumulating those international assets, then that would be, that's what we're trying to do. The second question was on the bonds. From the bonds, look, there's not a lot of money to be made from bonds, but you do want the insurance. There is a valuable insurance component that bonds act as. What we're been doing is very much playing at the shorter end of that, because which basically means we've got some bonds, but we're trying to stay away from interest rate risk. So as interest rates go up, bond prices fall. So we do expect, though, and that's on the back that we think there will be an inflation scare, and that people will be worried about it, and we'll continue to see more and more concerns about inflation over the next 6 months before it starts to fall away again. And so we're trying to be a little bit cute, I guess, in terms of waiting for the right time to start moving back towards the long end of it. I don't think it's yet, but I think you'll see rates higher in the shorter term before falling away once we get a clearer picture of what's happening in inflation. But the danger is, if you try and play that too early, is that you do get further spend, say, from Biden comes out with another bigger package or something like that, and you do get some real bursts of inflation, which is always possible. So for my part, it's about trying not to play that too much, trying to be more conservative, in terms of the timing of playing that.
And how does that then figure in the conversation about gold and silver?
Gold and silver. Yeah, well, look, if you treat gold as a currency, which I think, I think there's a few ways you can treat gold, but one is as an asset. If things go wrong, as an insurance asset. Secondly, as a currency. So if you're treating it as the anti-dollar, and you are expecting, if the US dollar is strong, then that's generally not a good thing for the gold price.
So it's interesting because
treat it as a separate.
Yeah. Because the gold and silver, of course, there's a big debate about what their true prices are, and there are some people who believe that the prices are artificially depressed, thanks to derivatives and all the other stuff, the one-to-many relationships. There are others who think that it's only a matter of time before they shoot through the roof. But if you look at the long-term trends, they haven't tended to perform particularly well vis-a-vis the markets over the long term.
No, there's... Well, look, in the end, it's a we could spend the whole thing on gold, couldn't we? I'm just trying to see how much trouble I want to get myself in before it. Look, I mean, I like gold at different times of the assets. I cycle as a hedge. And look, I hold a bit of gold at the moment without a strong view on it, with a view that, look, it's a hedge in there in case some of the things I'm expecting to go don't go the way I expect. So, the net effect is, It is a greater pool investment. The best thing you're hoping for is that somebody else will pay more for it. And so, central banks themselves own so much gold. If central banks decided to sell their gold, they could crash the price tomorrow. It's unlikely to happen. But when you're in a market where basically central banks and investors really drive the price, and so to bet on what other investors are going to do. I'd very much treat it as a currency at the moment. And so the question is, if everyone's trying to devalue their currencies, then that's when gold goes well. But if you're looking at a period where the US dollar is going to be stronger, then that's not a good sign for the gold price usually. And then the second thing as well is Bitcoin. The question is Bitcoin taking demand away from gold? And so especially if you're competing for investor attention, if you're basically saying, I want to buy gold because I think other investors will buy gold and then I'll sell it to them and that's how I'm going to make my money from it, is that if you're wrong because the other investors aren't buying gold, they're buying Bitcoin, then even if you don't like Bitcoin or don't think it's any good, that sort of ends up in that, you have a competitor for people's attentions.
Well, Bitcoin, of course, is momentum trading, right? So, you know, drops 20%, goes up 10%. 100%. Right. Yeah. Yeah, there's no logic, less logic to its fundamental value, but a lot of people are still trading it because of the momentum.
Yeah, and then some might argue that gold's got more because it's been around for 5,000 years and you've had, you know, that for, you know, and you have a tangible bit that people like and all those types of things. But yeah, there is there's a similar argument in that your main target is other investors. Mm. Yeah, they're the real swing factor.
And what I love about this is that, you know, you find a lot of people who are very strong on gold because they actually are in the gold sector and they actually want to sell more gold to other people, right? So sometimes some of those opinions may be a little bit vested, but I will leave it at that.
Well, I think the only thing I'd like to say as well is on the gold one is you just want to make sure that people – there's some people I know I listen to who are like saying, US dollar's going up, you got to buy gold. US dollar's going down, you got to buy gold. Inflation's going to be strong, you got to buy gold. Inflation's going to be weak, you got to buy gold. Like the answer's always buy gold regardless of whatever the economic input is. You'd like to sort of say, well, it's not going to be good in all scenarios, and it's about saying what scenario will gold be helpful for.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, it goes back to why are you doing it in the first place. Now, there's a couple of other interesting threads that were coming through as you were speaking. One of them was the manufacturing base that we don't have in Australia, right? Mm. And people were suggesting, well, you know, we've got lithium. Maybe what we should be doing is trying to build products and services around lithium, you know, energy efficient and all of those things, and try and lay a foundation for a different character of the economy here in Australia. Now, I've very strongly subscribed to the need to broaden the economic base in Australia because, frankly, we're digging a few things up and chuck them overseas, mostly iron ore, and then we're doing a lot of property building locally, and that's about it, right? What's your perspective? Do you think that's a good line of argument, or do you think it's not feasible?
No, I think there's. I think Australia's got some opportunities, some big opportunities in terms of being able to use cheap power to actually convert some of these products before we send them overseas. So rather than digging up all our alumina. Bauxite, sorry, and sending it overseas for people to turn it into aluminium is actually saying it's a very energy intensive process. It's saying, well, if we can get cheap power close to where it's being dug up, then we can convert it ourselves and send it overseas and make money off that. So, yeah, so very much a supporter for anything on that front. The issue is we're not cheaper with electricity at the moment. We're not cheap on our coal-fired. We're very cheap in terms of our solar power, especially during the middle of the day. And I think we've got that technological view that price is on a technology curve is going to keep coming down, and staying in front of that and taking advantage of it will be pretty key. On lithium itself, I'd love to see more R&D in battery technology. Within Australia, I think that would be helpful. I'd much prefer to see that we're experts in engineering and patents and other things like that, rather than experts are digging the stuff out of the ground and sending it to people elsewhere. In terms of the lithium that's here, I think Australia is obviously a very big producer of lithium. I guess the main one I'd say with lithium is, the amount of lithium used over the last few years has increased dramatically. But the lithium price has been sideways to down for a lot of that. And that's because lithium projects tend to need to be very big. They're a bit like iron ore in terms of you really need to get scale. In order to drive your cost, your unit costs down. And so over time, I'm not expecting that you'll see sort of small lithium mines pop up here and there. What you'll tend to see is a classic resource cycle where prices will shoot up and then somebody will build this really massive mine somewhere and then prices will tumble. And then you'll go through the same bit again. Nobody will build anything for a while because prices are low and then until prices climb. And then so within lithium, play that cycle. It's a pretty common metal that's out there. So, but it tends to be in these large deposits that will just send it through this classic cycle. So if you want to invest in the resource stocks, you know that you're one of those little fish eating off the edge of a big shark. But you know, would I like to see more investment in technology in Australia? Absolutely.
Mm. Yeah. And I guess the R&D landscape in Australia is appalling, right? I've spoken to so many startup businesses who can't get funding to be able to take their business forward. Unless it's a very specific niche or unless they've got really big wealthy friends, but quite often they end up going overseas simply because they cannot do it here locally. So there's a fundamental structural issue. And I have to say, I don't think the government's doing us any favours by tilting a lot of its investment towards the big end of town. I mean, there's a massive numbers of billions of dollars going through to the oil industry and the mining sector. I mean, there's a report that came out today, horribly large numbers going there, right? Just money being thrown at them hand over fist because, of course, they got all the weight. And yet there's very little support for some of those nascent new businesses that potentially could be taking us into different areas. It seems to be a fundamentally critical question.
Well, there's two parts to that. One part is the great Australian entrepreneurial dream for a lot of people is buy a house, stick a coat of paint on it, and then hold on to it for a year and flog it to somebody at a 10% premium. Like
That's entrepreneurial.
That's right. I've put on a particular color of paint, and you know, there's hundreds of shows to show you how to design this and knock that wall out. And so I think there is that part where it'd be nice to see a change away from property is the way to make money if you want to get rich in this country, if you want to get ahead, to let's go and start a business and do things. So I think there's some structural problems there, which I'd love to see change, but I'm not expecting to see change in the short term. In terms of government support, look, it's difficult, very difficult at that small end of the market because it's so intensive in terms of actually trying to work out what's worth it and what's not worth it. But I certainly concur with your thoughts that the venture capital market and angel investing is much, much bigger in the US than what you see within Australia. And there's a certain element as well of, I hope this isn't right, but somebody said it to me, and I guess stereotypically it seems right to me in Australia that, in the US there's often, they'll back people who go, well, he's failed twice, which means he's learnt or she's learnt from the mistakes and I like the idea and so therefore I'm going to give them another go. Whereas I feel as if, there is certain elements of the Australian psyche that says, failed twice, loser, never gonna win. That's not worth the investment. So, and I think Twiggy Forrest is probably a good example of that. He obviously, one of Australia's richest men, but failed high profile failures a couple of times before and needed to get mainly US capital to get the whole thing going.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the capital base here is way a lot smaller, isn't it, than internationally, which goes back to local versus international. But I guess, Damien, one of the questions I've got then is, you've got 2% here in Australia, you've got 98% around the world, right? You've got lots of different markets, you've got lots of different sectors within markets. How do you try and pick, particularly international winners? I mean, I guess the information flows are better these days because of the World Wide Web and internet and what have you, but is it tough?
Oh, look, absolutely. We only invest in large cap stocks. That's probably the first part where we're equivalent to the top 70 odd stocks in Australia. It's a global index called the MSCI World. And so what that means is they're big companies. They tend to be $10 billion plus. Investor relations are very good. They've already got, it's not like they're, an Australian company. And so people need to come to Sydney or Melbourne to see them. These are already companies that have investors right around the world. So they're used to doing, whether it's Zoom calls or phone calls or whatever and providing information to people online, conference calls, all that type of stuff is all just as accessible in here as what it is in the US. And what you find as well is the US is a very diverse market already, so that if a company's headquartered in Chicago, they already know they've got to deal with investors from right around the country, and so they're already sort of set up to deal with things remotely. So So yeah, so getting information flow is important. I think for us, we find there's certainly lots of big sectors where you just get so much more variety and so much more quality in terms of the companies. So the tech sector in particular is one where you can just access so many different elements of it and access, you're not sort of limited to a few companies. And Australia's had a few very good companies, but when you get a good tech company in Australia, it tends to get very expensive very quickly. And so, so for us, it's about trying to, you know, really move into stocks where we can sort of pick up that variety. And as I spoke to you about, you know, we're trying to get exposure to an infrastructure boom. It's a bit harder in Australia because you're mixed between stocks that are some stocks that have international exposures and stocks that are exposed to say the mining sector, where you might not have as a positive view. You can looking through international stocks, you're pretty sure there'll be one there that's got the type of exposure you want, and sometimes you'll find it at the right price as well.
Very interesting, yeah. And clearly, this is value investing, isn't it? This is looking for those opportunities where you think there is something there that's going to develop and create value, right? This isn't momentum trading.
No, definitely not. Yeah, so it's a mixture of, we do a mixture of what quality and value. So we put them on two axes. You know, one axis for how good quality the company is. The other axis shows you know, how cheap or expensive it is, and we try and buy stuff that's both good quality and cheap, which you tend, you know, there tends not to be much in that, but it is a trade-off between saying, okay, well, I'm happy to buy a very high quality company, you know, say a Microsoft or an Apple or something like that, when it's only average value or even a little bit expensive, I'm happy to buy it, as long as it's not horrendously expensive. And then on the flip side, there'll be companies like, you know, our cement manufacturers I was talking about before, where, look, it's a pretty basic business. It's not a high quality company in the long term. There are cyclical benefits to it. And if you can pick it up at a cheap price, then you do so. But when it gets up to be average value, then you're then looking to sell it.
Yeah, okay, very interesting. And that means active management, right? So you're sort of checking where you are and coming in, coming out, moving around.
Yeah.
Weaving and dodging.
Yeah, that's right. I tend to sort of go, think about, you know, it's a bit offense and defense, but, you know, there's quality stocks that'll sit in your portfolio and you're sort of like, well, they'll go up in price or go down in price, but I like them for the longer term, so happy to hold on to them for the longer one. Mm. What's worked really well over the last few months has been the value stocks, which are the ones where you do need to be a bit more active in. And when they do rally strongly, you do need to then take your profits and move on to the next one. So, so that's where we're expecting, you know, there's still a few more months to play out in terms of that value rotation back to before we start really pushing back into the loading up on quality.
Mm. And you mentioned, for example, there's some of the cement stuff that you were in, right?
Mm. Yeah, so it's there's other ones as well that you would go through. So it's a little bit in terms of banking, just given the point of the cycle, not because we're huge fans of the sector, but again, it's trying to get onto that value trade. There's stocks within some of the industrial sectors. There's some of the travel stocks. We've sort of got a bit of exposure there, and some of that's mixing between some tech and some non-tech within those. They tend to be sort of value stocks at depending upon where you are in the cycle. So that's sort of where we're looking for companies that will benefit from a cyclical upswing, which is sort of different to the companies, the real defensive companies we saw during the pandemic that outperformed.
Mm, very interesting. Now, I must share this one with you. This was from Aussie Jen. They said they should put wind farms all around Canberra to take advantage of all the hot air.
Yeah, that's right.
That was quite good. Big debate about, other types of power. But Vanessa asked another interesting question, which I'd be interested to get your take on. And that's relating to the VIX, you know, the volatility index. Is that something you look at? What's your view of it? Is it a good indicator or is it not?
Look, I don't think it's a predictive indicator. Let's put it that way. I think what it does do is it does give you an idea of how much fear is out there in terms of the option pricing, and how much complacency is out there. So I think from that perspective, I think it's worth looking at, and it's worth keeping in mind where it's at, and at levels when it starts dropping sort of below 15 is when I start to worry that, you know, is the market getting too excited about this? Is there do we need to worry about sort of everyone sort of piled onto one side of the boat, so to speak? And so if something happens that's unexpected, will you then find it sort of pushing back the other way? So the lower it gets, and certainly we've printed some very low numbers sort of 2 or 3 years ago. There was sort of a quant quake, or where the VIX sort of where sort of option pricing really blew out, which sort of threw a lot of people off over a little while. So it's certainly something we look at. There's some strategies that try and play off volatility. They can be expensive strategies if you get them at the wrong point of the cycle. So, there's some interesting ones. They're not something we do ourselves, but we think of ourselves as that core part of the portfolio, and people might want to do sort of volatility strategies around that. But it's, in my view, it's not something you should feel like you have to own.
That's very interesting. I've had some very interesting discussions over the years with regard to people who actually use the volatility index as their primary lever to jump or not jump, right? I've always been a bit more suspicious of it personally, because it seems to me to be rearview mirror rather than forward indicating.
Yeah. I think there's you can certainly point to plenty of times where it was a forward indicator, but I think for every one of those, you can point to a bunch of other ones as well where it gave the wrong signal by using it as an indicator. I think there's when it's high, you can pretty safely predict that eventually it will get lower, and when it's low, you can predict that it's going to spike higher at some stage, but knowing exactly when that occurs is obviously a lot more difficult.
Absolutely. Now, there's a bunch of other interesting questions, but I just wanted to sort of just steer the conversation slightly different. We made a show for your channel relating to property. I think it's coming out this Thursday, right?
Yes.
I don't want to reprise the whole of that show here now, but it is worth just highlighting that if you think about asset classes more generally, right, you've got stocks and shares, you've got bonds, you've got gold and silver and metals, and then you've got property. Now, my question to you is, all the analysis I've seen over the years suggests that actually in the long term, property doesn't necessarily perform that well relative to other asset classes. Have you got any thoughts on how those various asset classes stack up? And if you're a retail investor, what's the right mix between property-related investments and investments in other things like stocks? Have you got some thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, property's got the curse and the benefit that's a lot harder to measure than other assets. Because if I buy a bond, that's it. I've spent my money. Now I get my income, and eventually I get to sell my bond at the end of it. Or if I buy a share, I get a dividend stream, and then that's the end of it. You don't have to worry about I've owned it for 10 years, and so now I have to replace the kitchen or repaint the walls or all these other expenses that sort of go into the calculations. And so because it's difficult, most people just ignore those. And then, I've seen some analysis that talks about property being a fantastic investment class. You invested in medium property in 1900, and, by 2020, you'd gone up by some incredible amount. And you're like, yes, but the median house in 1900 was some small fibro shack somewhere, and somehow, and then by 1950 it was a three bedroom house in terrace house, and then by 2000s it was a McMansion was the median house. How did that happen? Did it just magically, it just assumed, well, I bought the median house, it must have then somehow magically transformed its well way over the time frame, and that's what I sold at the end of it. And so I think when you adjust those back, property's still a good asset. I have no problems with property as an asset, but it doesn't look anywhere near as good as if you take the headline figures. And it sort of reflects largely what you'd expect from these things in terms of you take the most risk in shares, and so you tend to get a higher performance. You take the least risk in short-term bonds or treasury bills, and so you get the lowest performance in those. And then it sort of works its way up. Property sort of sits somewhere between bonds and equities on that basis. What's it? Sorry, there was another question in there, which I'll...
let me just take the conversation like further. The point that people often forget is the cost of transacting, the cost of carry, right? That's the thing that people miss with regard to property, in my view.
Mm, absolutely. And you know, as much as they say there's hedonically adjusted and all these other factors, you know, if I buy a house, knock it down and stick up another house and then sell it for a big loss, most property indexes will treat that as a profit. So, you know, so I buy a place for $800,000, I knock the house down, spend $500,000 putting up another house. So I've spent $1.3, I sell it for $1.2, and most property indexes will still look at it and go, well, there's a three-bedroom house before, there's still a three-bedroom house, so it must be fine. Bought it for $800,000, sold it for $1.3 or $1.2 or whatever, you know, it's a win. And so, yeah, that is definitely... definitely not captured in it. And the right mix between property and shares.
Yep.
Look, I think the thing for me is to try to work out as well what shares are you exposed to or where are you exposed, because I think there's people who I've seen portfolios turned up and they've sort of come in from other planners or wherever, and they're like, yes, I've got a diversified property, I have an investment property, I've got a bunch of bank shares, I have some bank hybrids. You know, I've got this corporate debt stuff, and you know, I've got some term deposits, and you're like, right, you've got, you know, something you're exposed to the property market directly by here, and you work in, you know, a lot of these people might work as a, you know, in the finance industry and banking, or they might work in real estate or something like that. And you basically look, your job's reliant on it, your investment property's reliant on it, your banking shares are reliant on it, your hybrids are reliant on it, there's some corporate bond funds out there that basically just hold some of these things as well. You know, your whole portfolio is all geared towards, will the Australian property market go up or down? And it's been a great one for the last sort of 15, 20 years, but it's a question about going forward. I would much prefer to see a spread that, you know, you've got shares that, as we said, international shares or whatever that aren't exposed to the Australian property market. So with a view that, yeah, if the Australian property market goes up and you're already invested in it and all that type of stuff, it's happy days, you don't have to worry about it. But if it doesn't, you haven't put every single egg you have all into that one basket.
So the question then is leverage, right? Because most people, if they're buying property, they put, 10 or 20% in, right? They borrow the rest of the money and then they hope that it leverages up, right? So the argument that I keep seeing played out back to me is no, you misunderstand how property works, right? I don't need to buy 100% of the property. I'm buying 20% of the property, I'm borrowing the rest and paying it back over time. To which I reply, yeah, but that means you've got a negative cash flow, right? Because you're paying the mortgage.
Yes.
Right? Yes. And that somehow seems to sort of not count in people's calculations when they think about the leverage calculation.
No, that's right. It's a forced savings mechanism that people like as well, I guess. So sort of getting this sort of combined. But I think there's the leverage argument is a good one, and especially in Australia. We have a whole federal government devoted to trying to get as much leverage as possible to as many property investors as possible. So, but the issue is it cuts both ways, and so we get the right saying for this, but you know, using debt can turn a good investment into a great investment by using debt. But you know, it can also turn, you know, what might have been a low return investment into a bad investment, and it can turn a bad investment into a terrible investment. You know, the idea is that I might have got a 2% return on the property over a 5 or 10 year period. Yeah, okay, it's not a good return, but you know, at least it was positive, and I can walk away with more than what I put in. But if I've used too much leverage on that, then you know, I might find that I end up negative because I'm paying out all this money in interest and all the, you know, I bought something bigger than what I could have thought at the start, and so therefore there's all this extra stamp duty and everything like that, and I end up turning what might have been spent an average investment into a losing investment.
Yeah. But sorry, it seems to me. Go on. Sorry, I was. Didn't come across.
Go with that, and then we'll come back to interest rates.
So, okay. Well, I was just going to come on. It seems to me that one of the issues that people argue with property is it's tangible. You can see it. It's simple, right? Whereas buying stocks and shares or bonds and other things is actually a bit more complicated and a bit more diffused, and it's a bit harder to see what you've got. So tangibility, how would you sort of react to that, you know, in the light of what you said, and specifically about the risk of being over-leveraged into one sector of the market?
Yeah. Well, look, it certainly makes people feel better. You know, I won't deny that. So it really comes down to a question of saying how much do you need that sense of tangibility in terms of, you know, so let's say the gold, people who own the gold, you know, some people need to own it, need to have it stored somewhere where they can go and touch it because they have that same feeling. It's not an asset unless I can see it and feel it and touch it. I think the world is obviously moving more and more towards services and more towards technology where you can't see and touch things. And it's, you know, the world of 50 years ago, there was a big focus on manufacturing and the big focus on things you could see and touch. That's no longer the case. And so I think there's a, you know, our companies that are worth the most money in the world, you know, there's Microsoft and there's Facebook and there's Google and there's, you know, there's nothing you can see or touch with any of those products. They're all, you know, ether products out there and generating huge amounts of cash flow for their owners. So I guess it's a question of saying, you know, everyone needs to, we want everyone to feel comfortable in terms of the amount of risk they're taking with portfolios, especially, you know, portfolios that they come to us with. And we do have that part about, you know, you do need to get people step by step to feel comfortable with what they're doing. But a diversified investment in a wider range of stocks tends to be a very stable investment over the longer term and generate, you know, good returns. Would I want to see you sticking lots of debt against it? No, I definitely wouldn't. So, you know, in that respect, you know, property has its benefits in terms of those parts. But you know, the net effect really for me is being out of the danger as well is if you need to feel and see and touch all the properties you have, chances are they're all quite local to where you are, and you're putting even more eggs in one basket, if you know what I mean. You've made a bet on your local region plus, into one asset class.
And surely one of the critical things that you learn is to spread your risks, spread your asset classes, and, you know, try, because nobody quite knows how this is going to play out. And concentration risk is probably one of the most critical things that people don't get.
Yeah, well, and it's an important point as well for investing. It depends on, you know, I think there's some people come into investing and go, okay, I'm going to make a lot of money from this. I'm going to pile in. And if that's your whole goal, is you're in there to make, you know, bucket loads of money, then concentrated, you know, investments where you get it right is your only chance. But if you're there because you're saying, I'd like to make money slowly, I'd like to, you know, get rich slowly, as they say, or you'd like to there to protect money you've already made, or protect money you have actually saved, or is that's the part where you do need that diversification and spread around intelligently diversified, and you know, it's not a matter of just buying, you know, one of everything, but it is a matter of sort of, you know, on a risk-adjusted basis, sort of saying, well, okay, well, this asset class is quite expensive at the moment. I'll move out of that into this one, and then vice versa at other points of the cycle. But I think there's so diversification's very important.
So the last question for tonight, which is this: do we live in a freely operating market, or have we got something which is now completely controlled by central banks and quantitative easing and government policy?
You must have listened to some of these other podcasts we've been talking about.
Well, funnily enough, because it seems to me that some of the eternal verities of the way that economies work and the assumptions that people make are actually not adequately understanding how screwed the market is, if I can use that word in inverted commas, right? Because of government policy and because of intervention.
Yeah. Look, I've got a slide I put up in every podcast now because to remind myself as well as as well as listeners, which is just basically saying, you know, the biggest risk at this point in the cycle is policy error. And so we've got central banks pumping, the government's full of, the market's full of money. We have governments, you know, reducing the laws in terms of bankruptcies and letting people pay mortgages, get away without paying mortgages and pumping more money into the economy. The idea is if they withdraw too quickly or overstimulate, then that's where the dangers are, because there's really not a lot of there's not many places where the market can really go wrong, in terms of it being that the US Fed's is paying has will go into the corporate debt markets to buy corporate debt if they have problems within that market. So the issue is that if you look through the different areas, if there is a big blow up in say a hedge fund and taking too much risk, you know, will central banks sort of step in again, sort of similar to what they did in the LTCM crisis? And I say, yeah, at the moment they probably would. That whole issue where you've got to allow people to go broke seems to have gone out the window. The moral hazard, I suppose, in terms of saying yes, let's let people fail, has dropped throughout the coronavirus, and we're expecting that to keep going for a while longer, that there will be that moral hazard. So
that basically means that companies won't be allowed to fail, so we're going to have lots more zombie companies, right? It means that the expectation of the markets is that the central banks will always bail out the markets, which means that markets will never fall, right? It means that effectively likely to fall. And it means that the true value of things are effectively being masked by all those interventions.
Yeah, and so I guess the issue is, you know, from my perspective, if you saw a market where, say, over a five-year period, earnings recovers and it's already recovered and exceeded prior levels, but, you know, earnings works its way up to where you could justify sort of the current valuations, but the government sort of keep these markets by pumping more and more money in, they keep markets sort of relatively expensive the whole time, is that if you're sitting on the sideline with your cash waiting for, you know, I'm going to jump in at some stage, you might never get a chance to jump in. And so that's the part where it's about saying, well, how expensive do the markets get before you buy? You know, at the moment, we've obviously been on this great little run. I'm more concerned, more looking for a pullback and building up some cash and looking to pop in again. But we've still got a pretty full exposure to the market because of exactly the reasons you're speaking about. Distorted markets, plenty of money out there, and it's a question of saying, yes, it would be nice to sit on the sideline, wait for the markets to fall 30-40% and then pile in, but you might not get that chance in the next sort of 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, right, which is why your point about policy misstep is probably the most critical risk that we've actually got.
Yes, exactly. So watching for that, and if that happens, you know, then absolutely there'll be reason to get out of the market and to head for safety. But
the question I've got there is, central banks have been printing for a long, long time, you know, and you know, you could argue that the Fed started after the great financial crisis they've been doing more recently.
Bank of Japan started sort of 20 years or 15 years ago.
Yep. And they've still got no inflation, and they've still own a greater proportion of the economy than most other countries around the world. So, you know, I don't see any change of trajectory from any central banks. I mean, Canada's just signaled they might dial back their QE just a little, right? But, you know, just a tad. But there's no other indication of that. So they're going to do more of the same, aren't they? And yet, if you look back historically, it's not delivered the outcomes that they wanted to achieve. So I guess the question is, do you think they'll just go on doing more of the same?
Yeah, I do. I think the basic angle they have now, I think, is getting close to the right one. So I've sort of been quite critical of central banks for some time, in terms of it being that this whole expectation that yeah, you lower interest rates and then that'll sort everything out. Really needed more of a focus on, no, we need fiscal. We need governments to step in and start spending money and start that redistribution process and getting the, you know, changing that part, so that we can get some more money from rich people who tend to save it and more money for poor people who tend to spend it and sort of fix that demand equation. And so, so that's where, that's where I'm sort of really looking at is trying to, I've lost the train of the thought there.
No, that's cool. I think you actually came to a nice conclusion. And in fact, Cookie Boy was ahead of you because he said, thoughts on Biden's capital gains tax proposals, will it affect stock markets if it comes in? And what you're actually saying is this slightly tilt back so that it effectively it's trying to, you know, equalize the economy a little bit more. And that's presumably what the capital gains proposals would do. It would actually perhaps shift it a little bit, but not dramatically.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, most of the things they're talking about doing as well in the US are generally staged. I'm not sure with the capital gains tax ones, but obviously they're a little bit I don't think capital gains taxes, especially at the levels they're talking about, are really going to distort the economy too much, because if people are expecting the assets to go up, they're still going to buy those assets. If they end up, you know, they're expecting it from 100 to 120, they'll still go out and buy them. The fact they've now taken more of a, the government's taken a little bit more of that, I don't think is going to be enough for the levels to actually stop investment. And at that point, if that's what's happening, is that then hopefully that money then being recycled back into people who will then go out and spend it and actually create more demand, which will actually help the profitability of the companies in the first place.
So that's the real economy, which of course needs all the help. That's the point, really, isn't it? It's the real economy. It's the real economy, stupid, right?
That's what they should be saying. Yeah, that's right.
Now, Jason just asked you, do you hold any Bitcoin?
I don't hold any Bitcoin, though.
Fair enough. Easy conversation. I think that's pretty...
I think it's meant to be HODL anyway, isn't it?
Very good. So, look, we've come to can you believe another hour and a half flown by? I haven't got all the questions answered, but quite a few of them, which was good. Really appreciate your time tonight and your perspectives once again. I think the stream was very very appreciative of your comments. And guys on the stream, please like this post. We've only got 88 likes and there are several hundred on the stream. So please like before you go. And I will just mention again that you are releasing on Thursday on the Nucleus Wealth channel a conversation that we did specifically around property, right?
Yes, Sam. Yep. And actually, so it is worth noting as well, we had Catherine Cashmore, who's a buyer's agent, on last week as well on the property market. And so for anyone who didn't see that, the Crib Notes version of that was basically that she's in the Melbourne markets and it's hotter than she's ever seen it before. And that's basically the worst market in Australia at the moment. So, in terms of current conditions are certainly booming in terms of property markets. So, that's obviously not doesn't mean that that's where it's always going to go. And certainly some of the concerns we have, but, I think there's in terms of the property markets, right now it is running hot.
Yeah, it is. Houses, particularly units, less so, right?
And absolutely, yes.
Yeah, and that's the point I always come back to. I've done quite a few one-to-one shows recently with people who were expecting me to be able to say, yeah, everything's booming, and I immediately started highlighting the gaps between the two, right? So
yeah,
units and houses.
Actually, and that was very much the theme as well. And actually, it was interesting, one of the ones where she had thought, and the stuff she was looking at, some of the middle regions, middle rings around Melbourne actually had rents falling for houses as well. So while rents were rising overall, or maybe very slightly, I think, she'd thought there was actually, even within houses, they're starting to have this whole issue of investors just not getting, not getting the returns. They're not getting the rents you know, just not getting the rents. So yeah, that's that key one as well from an investment perspective. Yeah, much harder, obviously, falling rents around most regions.
Well, it shows that what we said last week, because we recorded your show before this one, right, was right,
yes,
because
right.
we discussed a lot of that in some detail, including some maps. And in fact, next week, I'll be taking that conversation a bit further forward on this channel. So, Damon, I really appreciate your time again tonight. And just to remind people, if you are interested in looking at the Nucleus Wealth Proposition, go to walktheworld.com.au. You can go from there and get all the information. Damien runs the sort of the investment portfolio, and there's also the advice. And we had a show the other day from Mr. Advice. So the two of them run this thing. And the reason that I think it's worth highlighting again, complete transparency of what's going on. You don't get that in many funds.
No, that's right. That's a and I think the part where we really are trying to offer that sort of integrated solution that sort of fits to directly to people, so that you're not going through six different levels of middle people. I think there's I've seen ones where the investor goes to a financial planner, who goes to their dealer group, who goes to an asset consultant, who goes to often another person who's checking what the asset consultants are doing, to somebody who does a tactical asset allocation, to the final funds who are sitting there. And there's just six different levels of people all needing to take a small fee.
Yeah, so clip the tickets all the way through. That's funny, isn't it? That's how the thing works. So that's one of the things that people need to know. So look, I really appreciate your time tonight. I guess we might do it again in about a month's time, regular spot, by which time I'm sure things will be different again. So
absolutely. Yes.
So thank you very much, and have a good evening. And I'll just close out the rest of the show, but I'm going to take you off there now. So thanks very much,
Damien.
Cheers. Bye. So there you go, folks. Very interesting conversation with Damon. As always, plenty of things going on. Nifi, thank you very much for that contribution. Really appreciate it. Thanks to all those others who actually provided some support via the show this evening. In terms of next week, you've got me coming on, and I'll be talking about the latest from the household stress and scenario updates, but I'll be specifically talking about rentals and rental streams and what's going on, because there's so much happening there. So mark your diaries and join me for that. And just to remind you, if you didn't see it, the last week's show, Senator Gerard Rennock, if you've not listened to that show, I do recommend it, because it really is a very important show in terms of talking about central banks and the Reserve Bank. Been a very widely and popular show, but if you've not seen it, it's still up there, so have a look at that. And without further ado, I just want to say thank you very much to everybody for watching the show tonight, and for answering, asking questions. We didn't get to all of them, but we got quite a few of them. And I look forward to seeing you again this time next week. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, signing off.